nationhood and the stifling attentions of the European nanny state, which has often made it more attractive not to work than to work.
The key word he used was possibility, because it really sums up everything that capitalism is all about. You stay at work an extra hour because of the possibility that your boss might notice and eventually promote you. You put your home on the line to start your own business because of the possibility that you might become the next Microsoft or Google. You spend your life savings to send your children to college because of the possibility that they will be presented with a life full of endless possibilities. As the Times columnist said, France has lost that, and it's not hard to understand why. Archaic laws, senseless social programs, poor but free education, enclaves filled with disenfranchised immigrants and unemployed youths, and massive public debt have combined to make France a nice place to visit, but a pretty depressing place to live.
ADD moment. If anyone from France takes offense at this, I'm sorry, but sometimes the truth hurts. At least take some solace in the fact that while your beloved country may already be too far gone to save, you could still stop us from suffering the same fate. Think of it more as a down payment on your balance from World War II.
I talk a lot about how our government, to borrow a term from the great economist Thomas Sowell, can't think beyond stage one. They try to solve problems with obvious solutions without thinking about the consequences of those solutions. But we didn't invent that kind of narrow, short-term thinking. France did. France decided that the best way to keep their citizens working was to create all kinds of laws and regulations for employers to follow. Most of us know about their 35-hour work week and long summer vacations, but that's only the start. The number of rules that French companies have to follow in order to hire or fire someone would put the New York City Teachers Union to shame. But what France forgot was that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. The consequence of all those laws to prevent unemployment was massive unemployment, especially among the young. It's really just common sense. If you can hire and fire at will, you're more likely to take a chance on new employees, especially young ones without much experience. But when at will instead turns into ironclad, virtually lifelong commitments, you're much more careful about whom you hire. The numbers show that this is exactly what happened, as 23% of young people in France are unemployed. To fight that trend, France's former prime minister created another set of regulations called the First Job Contract. It gives employers the ability to hire anyone under 26 years old for what is essentially a 2-year trial period. Now, 64% of all French youths aged 15 to 24 take part in the temporary work program within a year of completing their education. But many of them hate the idea. Having grown up in a country where a job was always viewed as a right, they believe the First Job Contract program victimizes them, and, as they say in their protests, institutionalizes insecurity. Maybe one reason why they say that is that, pardon my French, they're not that smart. After all, most students in France go to schools that are virtually free and have no restrictions on entry, including no minimum test scores or grade point average. In addition, teachers are government employees, which makes sense considering that over 25% of all jobs in France are in the public sector. The result of this wonderfully non-discriminatory sunshine and lollipops approach to education is a dropout rate of 40%, lecture halls that are bursting at the seams, universities without any interest in research, and the distinction of not even placing one school in the top 40 of the most recent worldwide rankings. France has only 3 schools in the top 100. Combining terrible educations with a government that acts like a countrywide HR department from hell does not exactly set the French up for economic success. And it shows. While the government takes 44% of GDP in taxes every year, the Eurozone average is closer to 40%, it's not nearly enough. Someone has to pay for all the free education, healthcare, and short work weeks, and right now it's France's lenders. A government commission report pointed out that without drastic action, France's debt load will go from 66% of GDP today to 80% by 2010 to a catastrophic 100% in 2014. Is America destined for the same fate? If we keep going the way we are, absolutely. For proof, just listen to the way a recent Economist article described the general attitude there. In France, there's a lingering culture of suspicion of profit and a demonization of business leaders, encouraged by a mainstream left that still equates efficiency with injustice. Now, ask yourself, is America moving toward that way of thinking, with all of its laws and feel-good regulations, or away from it?
Chapter 2. The Second Amendment. Ammunition to defend your rights. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Nothing illustrates the battle between the good forces of individual liberty and the destructive, idiotic forces of collectivism better than the ongoing battle over the meaning of those 27 little words. Normal people understand the natural existence of the right to bear arms, the plain language guaranteeing us that right, and the clearly documented history that led to its enshrinement in the Bill of Rights. But those who distrust individual freedoms in favor of an all-powerful government are horrified by the idea that one person could possess enough power to lawfully resist, with force, unacceptable intrusions into his or her life. Perhaps some of those opposed to the individual right to bear arms understand that, as King George once discovered, an armed populace is a populace that will not be pushed around. Perhaps they even understand Thomas Jefferson's famous observation, or was it a warning?
When governments fear the people, there is liberty. When the people fear the government, there is tyranny.
Whatever the reason, these people seem to appreciate, if not respect, the role of the Second Amendment in protecting our way of life. Successfully weaken it, and it's only a matter of time before all of our other rights begin to fall away, like dominoes. That's why so many of the debates over the Second Amendment aren't really about guns at all. They're about big versus small government, rights versus responsibilities, and ultimately, about where the balance of power in America should reside, with the politicians or with the people. That's also why it's so imperative that all Americans, gun lovers or not, understand their Second Amendment right well enough to fight for it against idiots who say things like, "Oh, it's clear that the right to bear arms only exists because a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. This right was about militias, not individuals."
They sure don't write laws the way they used to. Back in the 18th century, preambles like the one we see in the Second Amendment's Militia Clause were actually quite common. Who knows? Maybe the politicians were a little more modest back then and believed they had to offer explanations for the laws being handed down. But whatever the reason, the rules of English grammar haven't changed.
ADD moment. The argument that the Militia Clause somehow defines, narrows, or transforms the operative part of the right-securing language, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, proves only the sad state of modern education in America.
Just because the Second Amendment happens to have a preamble doesn't diminish the fact that the granting of this right to the people is perfectly clear. When our founders intended to specifically refer to the militia or the states, guess what? They used those words. Look at the 10th Amendment, for instance. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. Pretty clear, right? It becomes even more clear when you look at other instances where the founders used the language, the right of the people. Like in the First Amendment, for example, the right of the people peaceably to assemble. Or in the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures. The first clause of the Second Amendment, which discusses the necessity of a well-regulated militia, is a reason why the people have the right to arms. It's a perfectly good and sufficient reason, but it's not the only reason, and it doesn't change who has the right. Consider this sentence. Being a fisherman, Joe needs to buy a boat. Does that mean that Joe should buy a boat only if he fishes for a living? What if Joe also likes to water ski? Being a fisherman is a great reason for getting a boat, but it isn't the only reason, and in fact, it doesn't even have to be true. What if Joe is actually allergic to fish? What if Joe is an accountant who happens to enjoy sailing on the weekends? What if Joe is a strict vegan but loves to scuba dive? Would any of those reasons preclude Joe from buying a boat in any of those situations? Likewise, the militia clause of the Second Amendment doesn't have to be true for the rest of the statement to stand. What if a well-regulated militia is not necessary to the security of a free state? We're pretty secure and still kind of free these days, but we don't have a functioning state militia system. Perhaps the framers were wrong. Maybe the only thing necessary to security is a nuclear defensive umbrella, a strong navy, and just plain good luck. Does a constitutional right go away simply because one of its perceived benefits no longer exists? Of course not. No individual right depends on the government's actions. That's why the Declaration of Independence made clear that the rights we were fighting for were those we were endowed with by our Creator, instead of some elected bureaucrat. Judges and lawyers have understood that the flowery explanatory language of the sort we see at the outset of the Second Amendment is of little real value. That's why, for hundreds of years, such language has been widely ignored by courts, unless absolutely necessary to explain the operative text. In announcing one influential English decision in 1716, remember, they still used common sense back then, the judge called the idea that a preamble can limit or redefine the operative text a ridiculous notion. The reporter noting the decision even wrote that his lordship rendered his decision with some heat.
ADD moment. I wonder if any of our current reporters have used the term his lordship lately.
Over 100 years later, the interpretations were still the same. A mid-19th century legal treatise explained, when the words of the enacting clause are clear and positive, recourse must not be had to the preamble. And in this century, modern authorities declared that the preamble can neither limit nor extend the meaning of a statute which is clear. Similarly, it cannot be used to create doubt or uncertainty. If you're still not convinced, consider that the first Congress which approved the Second Amendment also reenacted the Northwest Ordinance, which laid out the settlement and exploration of what then passed for the frontier West. That law declared, religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. Many gun-grabbing idiots would disagree that religion, morality, and knowledge are necessary for good government. So does that mean that we can now do away with all public schools in the states of the old Northwest Territory? Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin?
ADD moment. Hang on just a second. No public schools? Maybe they're onto something with this whole preamble thing after all.
Even our original Constitution contains a Second Amendment-style preamble. Congress has the power to promote the progress of science and the useful arts by enacting copyright and patent laws. Does that mean that every copyrighted work or patented invention must promote scientific progress and useful arts? Suppose Al Gore's next book advocates a radical back-to-nature lifestyle that abandons the use of cars, planes, and electric power, things that would all be against scientific progress. Would Al Gore still be entitled to copyright it? Of course he would. Why? Because courts don't limit copyright and patent protection only to things that might promote the progress of science and the useful arts. In a very similar way, the right of the people, as stated in the Second Amendment, doesn't depend on and is not defined by those who take advantage of it only in the context of a militia.
Oh, but I've heard linguists say that the placement of commas in the Second Amendment changes what it means. Are you really saying that we shouldn't listen to highly educated and trained linguists?
The science of linguistics had not yet been invented by Noam Chomsky at the time the Second Amendment was written. but the rules of interpreting legal language were well understood anyway. Gun grabbers are not the only people who make bizarre arguments about the punctuation, capitalization, or format of a constitutional amendment they dislike. So do tax protesters, many of whom believe the 16th Amendment, which permits Congress to levy an income tax, wasn't legally ratified because of alleged errors and inconsistencies in the typography of the text. People who advance those kinds of arguments generally end up being able to have a lively debate over their insanity in the same place, federal prison. Relying on gobbledygook from the faculty lounge to contradict the plain meaning of the Second Amendment defeats a key purpose of having a Bill of Rights in the first place. As St. George Tucker, perhaps the leading legal scholar of the Second Amendment's day, said, "A Bill of Rights may be considered not only as intended to give law and assign limits to government, but as giving information to the people so that every man of the meanest capacity and understanding may learn his own rights and know when they are violated." Sadly, Tucker apparently grossly overestimated the intelligence and meanest capacity of some people.
Yeah, but there's got to be some logical reason why the Second Amendment mentions a militia. I think it means people can only have guns when they're acting as soldiers.
The gun grabbers like to fantasize that the founders used militia to mean a government-organized military unit. But, as usual, they couldn't be more wrong.
ADD moment. We've really changed what the definition of a militia is. Back in the 1700s, it meant all able-bodied men. But now, a militia member seems to be anyone who's not perfectly in the mainstream. According to a report done by the Missouri Information Analysis Center, people who endorse third-party candidates are pro-life activists, enjoy the film America, From Freedom to Fascism, or most ironically, fly the Gadsden Don't Tread on Me flag, might just be in a militia. Of course, that's not all bad news. I mean, if we use their definition, then everybody who voted for Ron Paul or is against Roe versus Wade has the right to bear arms, no matter how you interpret the Second Amendment.
The Constitution gave Congress the power both to raise and support a national army and also to organize the militia. The army had to be raised because it didn't naturally exist in society. But the militia, on the other hand, only had to be organized. Why? Because it was a pre-existing concept. In debating the Constitution, George Mason famously asked, "Who are the militia?" Surprisingly, his answer didn't include camo-clothed, beer-drinking rednecks, talk radio listeners, or Bob Barr supporters. In fact, Mason was asking a rhetorical question. The militia, he said, consists now of the whole people. They still do. Hundreds of years ago, people feared the idea of a permanent standing army because their experience had been that, in times of peace, standing armies would occupy themselves by repressing the citizenry. Modern police departments didn't develop until the 19th century, so with no army and no cops, peace and order were maintained by the militia, a group of ordinary civilians who were expected to use their own arms to defend the community. As the Supreme Court long ago explained, the militia system implied the general obligation of all adult male inhabitants to possess arms and, with certain exceptions, to cooperate in the work of defense. It went on to say that the militia are not troops or standing armies, but civilians primarily, all males physically capable of acting in concert for the common defense. James Madison, the author of the Second Amendment, plainly understood that the militia meant able-bodied citizens, dismissing fears that a federal army might become as oppressive as the English redcoats. Madison noted that America had a militia amounting to near 500,000 citizens with arms in their hands. And, according to Madison, this broadly defined militia held the advantage of being armed, which the Americans possess over the people of almost every other nation, with governments that are afraid to trust the people with arms.
ADD moment. James Madison may have been a brilliant man with extraordinary foresight, but even he apparently couldn't fathom a time when our government wouldn't trust their own citizens to bear arms. If he had fathomed it, he might have written the Second Amendment a little differently, like, "All citizens have the right to keep and bear arms, dummies."
It might be difficult to imagine this today, but during the Revolution, cities like Boston and New York had accurate, quality newspapers. The Boston Evening Post once reported that the total number of militia in the large province of New England is upwards of 150,000 men who all have and can use arms, while the New York Packet once declared, whoever asserts that 10 or 12,000 soldiers would be sufficient to control the militia of this continent, consisting of 500,000 brave men, pays but a despicable compliment to the spirit and ability of Americans. The colonies, then the states, and now the federal government have long declared exactly which part of the population might be organized as militia. Today, federal law defines the militia of the United States to include all able-bodied males from 17 to 45 and members of the National Guard up to age 64, but excluding those who have no intention of becoming citizens and active military personnel. To translate, that means that every able-bodied guy of a certain age who's not in the military is in the militia. Once we understand that, it's easy to see the relationship between the Second Amendment's militia purpose and its rights-securing language. If the people cannot have guns, they cannot function as militia when needed. After all, people who are called to perform militia duties are expected to appear bearing arms supplied by themselves and of the kind in common use at the time. No guns, no militia. While George Mason may not have fully understood just how complex the debate over his desired protection for the right to arms would eventually become, he did realize the threats the system might one day have to endure. He explained, "The militia may here be destroyed by that method which has been practiced in other parts of the world before, that is, by rendering them useless, by disarming them."
Ah! So it is about people acting as a militia in defense of the country. That's why the Second Amendment doesn't say anything about self-defense.
Because it doesn't have to. The militia purpose was one purpose that folks who had just overthrown a tyrannical king thought would be important for future generations to remember. But everyone understood that the right of the people to keep and bear arms referred to an individual right to use guns in self-defense. It was so obvious that it didn't even need to be said. Unlike America, England had no militia system to speak of. Yet in the 1689 Declaration of Rights, the king agreed that the subjects which are Protestants may have arms for their defense suitable to the conditions as allowed by law. By 1744, English law had already settled and determined that a man may keep a gun for the defense of his house and family. John Adams, in defending the Redcoats at the Boston Massacre trial, declared, "Here, every private person is authorized to arm himself, and on the strength of this authority, I do not deny the inhabitants had a right to arm themselves at that time for their defense, not for offense." The disarmament of the people of Boston provoked outrage from the Continental Congress. In 1791, the realization of the need to band together as militia was fresh in people's minds, so we'd expect the Second Amendment to highlight that function of the right to arms. But that doesn't exclude other functions, especially one like the right to self-defense that was already so widely understood.
Okay, but even if the militia refers to ordinary citizens, the Second Amendment says the militia should be well regulated. So obviously they were talking about gun control.
I know this is hard to believe, but in 1791, America was a much more free country than it is today. Missing from the landscape were the endless numbers of alphabet soup agencies and two-bit bureaucrats that now seem to infect every aspect of our lives. Only a true idiot would envision our Bill of Rights as a celebration of regulation. The term well-regulated meant something very different to our ancestors than it now does to some pencil pusher at the Federal Bureau of Regulation's Administration of Government Initiatives. As noted by the Oxford English Dictionary, well-regulated meant well-functioning, i.e. well-regulated appetites, 1709, well-regulated clock, 1812, and well-regulated mind, 1862. When speaking specifically of troops, regulated means properly disciplined. Discipline, in turn, means training in the practice of arms. The patriots who formed militia groups to resist British rule, including George Washington, described their groups as well-regulated militia. Knowing the definitions, what do you think makes more sense? That Washington's neighborhood militia was granted the royal seal of approval by some kingly regulator, or that his militia was properly trained in the practice of arms?
Okay, all right. Even if the founders weren't talking about regulation then, they'd surely be for it now, because they didn't face the same kind of violence and crime that we do.
Some people believe that people are now so much smarter than those dead old guys who like to dress up in wigs, got rid of the king, and wrote our Bill of Rights. In their world, gun violence is not only a problem that didn't exist in the 1700s, it's also a problem that the framers could never have even foreseen because they were living in a quaint, peaceful time, and their ideas, while imaginative for 300 years ago, aren't so hot today. Not so much. Whatever else has changed over the years, it's not human nature. People alive in the 1700s were just as violent and crazy as they were in the 1800s, 1900s, and today. All of the modern arguments we hear about gun control today were made back then, considered, and rejected. On July 7th, 1775, the New Bern, North Carolina Gazette reported that a demoniac shot three people and wounded a fourth with a sword before being shot by others. Note the fact that sane, law-abiding people with guns handy kept the lunatic from racking up a greater body count.
ADD moment. Nothing makes people call for gun bans more than a terrible tragedy. But if we gave in to that temptation and banned guns every time one was used in a mass murder, then we'd never even have the Second Amendment because demoniac would have convinced everyone that guns are evil. Unfortunately, England didn't have the same resolve. After the 1996 Dunblane massacre, in which a man shot and killed 16 children and their teacher at a primary school, England instituted a handgun ban. More on how that worked out later.
It's not as though there was no gun crime back then, or that nobody thought about whether disarming the population would result in less violence. It's just that after thinking about it, they realized it would never work.
The less you know. The demoniac of 1775 went on his shooting spree 3 months after the Revolution's bloody opening at the Battle of Lexington and Concord, and less than a year before the Declaration of Independence was signed. Given that environment, it's not surprising that the Gazette also carried this clear message from the Continental Congress. It is the right of every English subject to be prepared with weapons for his defense.
In 1764, Italian Marquis Cesare Beccaria published On Crimes and Punishments, a book credited with founding the science behind modern criminology. Our founders were quite familiar with Beccaria's work. John Adams confidently quoted from it to the jury during the Boston Massacre trial, and Thomas Jefferson was also a fan. In his own commonplace book, Jefferson copied Beccaria's passage, denouncing gun control, and even called gun control an example of false utility, a backwards and irrational approach to crime prevention that will only make the problem of criminal violence worse. According to Beccaria and Jefferson, gun control laws disarm those only who are neither inclined nor determined to commit crimes. Can it be supposed that those who have the courage to violate the most sacred laws of humanity, the most important of the code, will respect the less important and arbitrary ones, which can be violated with ease and impunity, and which, if strictly obeyed, would put an end to personal liberty? Such laws make things worse for the assaulted and better for the assailants. These laws are not preventive, but fearful of crimes, produced by the tumultuous impression of a few isolated facts and not by thoughtful consideration. Gun laws don't deter criminals, but they do disarm the law-abiding, making them easier to attack and eventually leading to the end of individual freedom. These laws are produced by panicked reaction to individual incidents and not, as the authors of our Declaration of Independence once said, by thoughtful consideration.
Okay, there have always been violent criminals, but the Second Amendment is outdated. We have a modern police force, so citizens don't need guns anymore.
So in other words, we can just ignore the parts of the Constitution that we feel no longer make sense because they're outdated. Sweetness. Why stop with the Second Amendment? What if some unelected crazy judge somewhere thinks it would be good to bring back slavery? Or eliminate the right to privacy? Or stop having free and fair elections? After all, we keep voting for Bushes, Clintons, and Kennedys anyway. Why not just set up some sort of rotating monarchy? If the intent is really to reduce crime and violence, the Second Amendment is an odd place to start. After all, Saudi Arabia and North Korea seem pretty peaceful and orderly. So why not mimic them and eliminate our Fourth Amendment so that police can search wherever and however they want and arrest people who just don't look right? What have you got to hide if you haven't done anything wrong? We can get rid of the Fifth Amendment, too. Due process? Waste of time. If we can make you confess to a crime, all the more efficient. The Sixth Amendment? Give me a break. Jury trials? Why? So we can have O.J. fool a bunch of morons? Do you really need a lawyer to explain your actions if you're innocent? But the real culprit here, the part of the Bill of Rights that kills the most Americans by far, is the Eighth Amendment. You know, the one that says fines can't be excessive and that people shouldn't be subjected to cruel and unusual punishment. Why? We're talking about guilty people here. Criminals! A few public beheadings or Taliban-style floggings, broadcast in primetime right between cops and America's Most Wanted, and crime rates will plummet. If we're really worried about public safety, there are lots of other things in the Constitution to target that would be far more effective. But idiots don't target those things because they know they'll lose. So they start with the Second Amendment and hope, as I said before, that destroying it will lead to a domino effect.
I'm saying it's outdated because the guns they had in 1791 were muskets, not modern weapons. Those aren't protected. And by the way, stop calling me an idiot.
Does the First Amendment protect only the sort of speech that existed in 1791? If you're struggling with the answer to that rhetorical question, then I'm not sure I actually want you to be able to own a gun. Back in the 1700s, Al Gore hadn't yet invented the internet, and with no radio or television, Keith Olbermann hadn't yet invented hypocrisy. Yet the First Amendment protects both of those people, along with the millions of others who use new mediums to broadcast things that other people might find outrageous. Al Gore could pole dance topless in an internet broadcast that is then turned into a Larry Flint Blu-ray DVD, and it would all be constitutionally protected. Anyone trying to stop it would likely find a militia of ACLU lawyers trying to bury them under the courthouse.
ADD moment. It would be an interesting case on whether that ACLU militia could bear arms.
In 1791, we had very few practitioners of Wahhabist Islam on these shores. Mormons? Zero. Joseph Smith wouldn't be born for decades. Chicken-sacrificing voodoo preachers? Scientologists? Nope, not on the Mayflower. Yet today, all of those religions, along with hundreds of others, are protected by the First Amendment's guarantee of religious freedom. How about our Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches? Back in 1791, there were no telephones to tap. Yet the police now generally need to get a warrant before they can spy on your telephone conversations. Back then, there were no helicopters to hover over your house with special thermal imaging cameras that could peek through your roof to detect drug-making equipment, but that, too, is now considered a violation of your Fourth Amendment rights. All of our other rights, protected by the Bill of Rights, have expanded based on evolving technology. So why should the right to bear arms of all kinds not evolve with technology? Again, if that question is hard for you to answer, then you might have a bigger problem with our Constitution than just its Second Amendment.
Okay, fine. The Second Amendment, it protects all normal guns, but not assault weapons.
What's an assault weapon?
You know, weapons of war and things, you know, things that should be on a battlefield, not in your house.
So should the law ban only things that belong on a battlefield?
No, the law should ban assault weapons.
Oh, okay, thanks for clearing that up. Few rational people dispute that there are some weapons that should be banned from private ownership. Ted Turner may own half of Montana, but he can't defend it with nukes.
ADD moment. I'm not singling Turner out just because he's cozy with the United Nations, has a tendency to marry Viet Cong agents, and is prone to saying stupid things, i.e.,
we'll be 8 degrees hotter in 10, not 10, but in 30 or 40 years, and basically none of the crops will grow, most of the people will have died, and the rest of us will be cannibals.
Seriously, he really did say that.
The Supreme Court tells us that the Second Amendment protects the possession only of weapons that can be carried on one's person and are of the type that would be in common use for lawful purposes. But where do assault weapons fit into that? It depends. The word assault doesn't tell us anything, because any object used to harm another person can be designated as an assault weapon. If a mugger uses a kitchen knife, baseball bat, or fireplace poker to prey on his victims, should Congress label those items as assault weapons and ban them from private homes? It seems logical that if a gun is going to be banned for being an assault weapon, there should be something about it that makes it particularly useful for criminals, but useless for lawful applications. Unfortunately, there's nothing logical about the agenda of gun grabbers. They're focused on banning as many guns as they can as fast as possible, common sense be damned.
ADD moment. These bans have very little to do with what the guns actually do, and a whole lot more with their cosmetic appearance. Maybe a more accurate term for an assault weapons ban would be a scary-looking weapons ban, or a cool-looking weapons ban, depending on your point of view.
But aren't assault weapons the same kinds of machine guns that Rambo and Chuck Norris use in the movies? You know, those guys have killed a lot of people with those guns.
No. The sort of assault weapons that might be used in the military or the movies are machine guns, i.e. guns that spray bullets everywhere. They are called fully automatic weapons because the gun automatically loads and then fires bullets for as long as the shooter keeps pressing on the trigger. These types of guns have been heavily restricted in the United States since the mid-1930s and are not covered by the assault weapons ban laws.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that the assault weapons ban doesn't cover military-issue weapons?
That's right, but don't take it from me. In a 1988 report laying out their strategy for banning so-called assault weapons, the Violence Policy Center declared public confusion to be a key aspect of their strategy. The weapons' menacing looks, they wrote, coupled with the public's confusion over fully automatic machine guns versus semi-automatic assault weapons, anything that looks like a machine gun is assumed to be a machine gun, can only increase the chance of public support for restrictions on these weapons. The gun grabber's amazing dishonesty is right there, in plain view. They know that by inciting confusion, they prevent people from asking logical questions. Questions that gun prohibitionists can't answer.
The less you know. In case you're not familiar with them, i.e. you're a normal person, the Violence Policy Center isn't some right-wing think tank funded by the gun lobby. In fact, they're just the opposite. They believe that guns are actually a public health issue and should be subject to government health and safety regulations. So, when they talk about the public's being confused by the terminology, they mean that in a good way.
Let's take a look at what these assault weapon bans actually prohibit. First, these laws pertain only to semi-automatic guns. The term semi-automatic may seem exotic to those unfamiliar with guns, but most guns made in the last 100 years fall into this category. It just means that one bullet will be fired each time the trigger is pulled. Keep your finger down on the trigger, and you'll get a whole lot of nothing. Semi-automatic guns will not spray bullets, but you do not need to manually reload each bullet into the chamber, a distraction that usually makes most target shooting and self-defense uses far less effective.
Excuse me, Mr. Serial Killer, I missed. Please just sit still while I get another bullet ready to go.
ADD moment. Manual reloading of guns does, however, provide a much better drama for the scene in the movies where the hero has to struggle to get another round in the chamber as the madman defies all laws of medicine by rising up from the floor after taking a shot to the head.
So what is it that turns a normal, garden-variety, semi-automatic gun used for plinking at empty bottles and rapists into an evil assault weapon?
Good question. Here's what the Guns Are a Public Health Issue Violence Policy Center says.
Defining an assault weapon, in legal terms, is not easy. It's not merely a matter of going after guns that are black and wicked-looking. Although those involved in the debate know the weapons being discussed, it's extremely difficult to develop a legal definition that restricts the availability of assault weapons without affecting legitimate semi-automatic guns. Although legislation could be passed that would ban specific weapons, the world's arms manufacturers are expert at producing weapons that follow the letter but not the intent of the law. This often results in products that are virtually identical to the restricted weapon, yet different enough to remain on the market.
So, the gun grabber's way around the fuzzy definition of assault weapons is to ban specific rifles and handguns, as well as all guns that have certain features. The now-expired federal assault weapons ban, enacted in the early Clinton days, put that kind of philosophy into practice. First, a laundry list of specific guns by make and model were deemed to be assault weapons. And second, any gun that had some combination of evil features was banned. But there's a big problem with that approach. Looking at the evil features targeted by the assault weapon bans makes the cosmetic nature of this game completely obvious. For example, despite the almost complete lack of criminal bayoneting in this country, an amount that could accommodate a bayonet counted as a strike against a gun. Pistol grips and folding stocks, features designed to make guns easier to aim and shoot accurately and comfortably, were also deemed evil and counted as another strike. But shouldn't the government want people to be more accurate shooters? Cumbersome guns probably lead to more stray bullets. But don't expect the gun grabbers to understand what they're banning. New York's Carolyn McCarthy, who's arguably the loudest anti-gun voice in Congress, was campaigning for renewal of the federal assault weapons ban when she was asked why she wanted to ban guns that had barrel shrouds. Now, McCarthy knew she wanted to ban barrel shrouds, but didn't know why. So what is a barrel shroud? Well, because gun barrels can become too hot to hold when they're in use, a barrel shroud is a piece of vented metal or plastic that surrounds the gun barrel, thereby allowing the user to hold it steady while shooting. In other words, barrel shrouds make guns safer and easier to shoot.
ADD moment. Barrel shrouds, unfortunately, violate the cool-looking test, which is why we apparently can't have them.
Of course, like most gun grabbers, Congresswoman McCarthy didn't seem to know any of those details. When asked, "Do you know what a barrel shroud is?" her answer was as stunningly honest as it was scary.
"I actually don't know what a barrel shroud is. I believe it's a shoulder thing that goes up."
"Well, if we can have modern guns, then maybe we should also be able to have, you know, modern restrictions, and gun control is one of them."
That clearly doesn't work. The statistical games played by gun prohibitionists are more creative than Charlie Rangel's excuses for why he didn't follow the tax laws he was in charge of writing. For some people, believing that guns are harmful is like global warming, an article of faith. Science be damned. But more rational people who are willing to consider neutral sources, like those wild-eyed gun nuts at the National Academy of Sciences and the Centers for Disease Control, soon realized that the evidence points in a completely different direction. In 2003, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published a study investigating whether gun control actually works. They examined all sorts of gun laws, from bans on different firearms and types of ammunition to licensing and registration mandates, waiting periods, laws designed to keep guns away from kids, and harsh enforcement regimes for different gun violations. Their conclusion? Nothing seemed to work very well. A year later, the National Academy of Sciences published a comprehensive review of 253 journal articles, 99 books, and 43 government publications evaluating 80 gun control schemes. The total number of gun laws found to reduce violent crime, suicide, or accidents? Zero.
"Really? So then why does gun control work so well in other countries, Mr. Smarty Pants?"
"It doesn't. Remember the English Declaration of Rights with its right to arms? Like the rest of that declaration, it restrains only the Queen. Parliament can do whatever they want, and being that they are idiots, they wanted to take guns away. So, in 1997, they did. Over a decade later, the results are in. The ban is a disaster. From 1998 through 2005, the number of deaths and injuries from handguns skyrocketed 340%. But that statistic shouldn't be surprising. One European study of 21 countries recently found no significant correlations between the number of guns in society and the corresponding suicide or homicide rates. Another study comparing suicide and homicide data for 36 countries, including the U.S., between 1990 and 1995, reached the same conclusion. A third study, done in 2007, compared gun ownership and murder rates in almost every European country. It found the countries with more widespread gun ownership had fewer murders, while countries with less gun ownership had, say it with me, more murders.
Gun ownership promotes vigilantism. Why not just call 911?
There are many heroic police officers who rapidly and professionally respond to any threat, blowing away the villain or arresting the criminal and saving otherwise helpless citizens from harm. In the movies. In real life, as the saying goes, when seconds count, the police are only minutes away. Let me illustrate what I mean by picking just one crime-riddled, tough-on-gun city, Washington, D.C. In 2002, almost 30 years into a gun ban, which was overturned by 2008's landmark Supreme Court case, District of Columbia versus Heller, the D.C. police force's response time to a Priority 1 call was 8 minutes, 25 seconds. That's almost 8.5 minutes from the time the dispatcher has spoken with you and determined that there's an intruder in your home to the time the first squad car arrives. Of course, that response time assumes that, one, you actually get a chance to make the call, and two, once you make the call, someone will answer. In 1998, a newspaper investigation discovered that nearly 90,000 callers to 911 had to wait at least 90 seconds for an answer. Another 32,000 callers either couldn't connect at all or got so tired of waiting that they gave up. As the hysterically anti-gun Washington Post opined a few years ago, the 911 system is a joke. 4 years later, anti-gun councilman Jack Evans claimed, "Somewhere the system is still not working even after all the money we've put into this."
ADD moment. Things you can do in the 8.5 minutes it takes the D.C. police to respond to a Priority 1 call. Brew a pot of tea for your intruder. Deal him a deck of blackjack. Dance the Macarena with him. Twice. Scan the New York Times book review. Listen to 5 appeals for donations from NPR. And play a game of Russian roulette. Which is exactly what you're doing if you leave your family security completely up to the police.
The 911 problem isn't unique to Washington, D.C. Call 911 in Nassau County, New York, and you might get a recording with some calming music. The police response time to 911 calls in New York City, 7.2 minutes. Los Angeles, 10.5 minutes. Atlanta and 3 neighboring counties, 11.1 minutes. Philadelphia, almost 7 minutes. St. Petersburg, Florida, just over 7 minutes. While on hold, would you rather be holding a loaded handgun or a wooden spoon? It's not as though there aren't enough cops in Washington to respond. The city has the highest police officer to citizen ratio of any city in America, yet year in and year out, it's also the nation's murder capital. More cops, more crime? The city's police force might be more effective if it had a competent leader. But former Washington, D.C. Police Chief Charles Ramsey subscribes to the set the bar low and you'll never be disappointed theory of governance. In 2002, he cut his target for closing homicide cases from 65% down to a lowly 50.9%, explaining, "It's more encouraging. You get these stretch goals, and when you don't even come near it, you get hammered for it." But even with those laughable goals, the numbers are still fudged. If a murder occurred in a prior year and isn't solved, it doesn't count against them, even though it's still very possible to find the killer. But if by some stroke of luck, a murder that occurred in a prior year is suddenly solved, it counts toward the department's success. They can't lose.
ADD moment. If we follow the same logic in baseball, everyone could bat 1,000 all season long. The only at-bats that count would be the one where the batter gets a hit.
What's amazing is that even with the fudging of prior year numbers, the rate at which DC solves murders is still barely over 50%. And since that rate includes solved murders from prior years, the real odds of someone finding your killer the year you were murdered is very, very low. The truth is that it's often harder to open a business or find a parking spot in Washington, D.C. than it is to get away with murder, which is probably one big reason why there are so many of them.
The Less You Know. A 2001 audit of D.C. numbers by the Office of the Inspector General revealed that the real murder clearance rate isn't 50%, it's 6%. I'm just thinking out loud here, but maybe the reason why there is so much gun violence in D.C. is that the criminals know they'll never get caught.
But aren't the police required to try their best? I mean, don't they take an oath or something?
In America, you have the right to own a gun, the right to defend yourself with it, and the right to ask your assailant to sing Kumbaya, explore his feelings, and understand how the lack of social justice in an oppressive capitalist culture forced him into bludgeoning your forehead with an axe. But the right you don't have is the one where you ask Kevin Costner to get all bodyguard with you. Despite what you may think, you do not have a right to police protection, and once you're dead, nobody can sue the police for failing to protect you, no matter how incompetent they may have been. The idea that police aren't responsible to crime victims is well entrenched in our legal system. One of the leading cases on this point comes to us, surprise, surprise, from our nation's capital. In March 1975, just as city officials were gearing up to ban guns, two Washington, D.C. women were awakened by the sound of their back door being broken down. Moments later, they heard their roommate's screams downstairs as she was being raped by two thugs. They quickly called 911, who advised them to remain quiet until the police arrived. The dispatcher called police but didn't tell them that the call was very important. It rated only a code 2, a lower priority than a crime in progress. Four police cars responded to the call, and three of them actually went to the victim's home. The two roommates who had called the cops managed to sneak out onto the roof, where they witnessed one police car drive slowly past their house. Another officer actually got out of his car, went to the front door, and knocked. When the rapists didn't answer the door and offer them fresh-made lemonade, the police left. They'd been there a whole 5 minutes. The two women crawled back into the house. With their friends still screaming, they called the police again and were again told that help was on the way. But this time, the dispatcher recorded the call only as investigate the trouble, and nobody ever did. Believing that the police were on the scene, the two roommates called out to their friend. Big mistake. The rapists kidnapped all three women and brutalized them for another 14 hours. Given that the rapists were armed only with a knife, would it have made a difference if the women had a gun? We'll never know. It's hard to imagine how this could have turned out much worse, until the women sued the police department and lost. As horrible as all of this was, the police owed these victims nothing under the law. Another reminder that the person most incentivized to keep you safe is you.
Okay, that one's terrible. But there's some situations where the police are ordered to protect people.
It doesn't matter if a judge has ordered the police to protect you. They still can't be held legally responsible for failing to do so. Jessica Gonzalez suffered a rough divorce from her violent husband and obtained a nice piece of paper from the court commanding him to stay 100 yards away from the family home at all times, unless he was coming to pick up the couple's three young daughters for a prearranged visit. The nice piece of paper also commanded the local constabulary, "You shall use every reasonable means to enforce this restraining order." It even said they could arrest the bad guy or seek a warrant for his arrest if he violated or tried to violate the order.
ADD moment. Which piece of paper would you rather have? A piece of paper that tells violent psychos to leave you alone, or a piece of paper that lets you have a gun?
You can probably guess why this story is included in this chapter. The jerk kidnapped the children as they played outside the house. About 2 hours later, Jessica called the police. Two officers showed up, but told her they weren't going to do anything and suggested she call back if the kids weren't back by 10 p.m. At 8:30 p.m., Jessica called her ex-husband, who claimed to have the kids at an amusement park. She called the police back, but was again told to wait until 10. At 10:10 p.m., Jessica called again, but was told to wait until midnight. At 12:10 a.m., she was told to wait for an officer to arrive. When nobody showed up by 12:50 a.m., Jessica went to the police station herself. The nice officer took a report and then went to get something to eat. The police got one thing right. They had no need to exert themselves to find Jessica's ex-husband. He showed up at the police station himself at 3:20 a.m., shooting. The police gunned him down, but the three little girls, Rebecca, Catherine, and Leslie, ages 10, 9, and 7, were already dead. It's hard to know if the gun in Jessica Gonzalez's hands would have made matters better, but it's hard to argue that they could have made things any worse. The police's guns proved useful to resolve the issue with her ex-husband, if regrettably too late, but as a legal case against the police department, the outcome was never in doubt. The Supreme Court held that Jessica had no constitutional interest in having the nice piece of paper enforced.
Well, at least the police are specially trained to kill the bad guys. For all the macho talk of gun nuts, I bet most of them would freeze up if they faced a real threat.
The great thing about guns is that almost all defensive uses of them involve an actual shooting. Most criminals aren't looking to risk getting shot. They're looking for an easy victim. If a potential victim is armed, that's cool with the crooks. They'll find some other poor sucker who isn't. It's a lot like installing an alarm in your house. Sure, a criminal can still break in, but why bother when there are so many other homes without them? Actual reports of successful defensive non-shootings are low, and you won't find them in the news. Nothing could bore the media more than no shots fired, but that doesn't mean they aren't out there. Social scientists studying the phenomenon disagree widely about the actual numbers, but one set of 13 different surveys yielded results ranging from 760,000 to over 3 million defensive gun uses per year. According to another particularly well-respected survey, no shots were ever fired in over 3/4 of such defensive gun uses. If you're one of those statistics, I bet you probably have a pretty healthy respect for your Second Amendment rights.
ADD moment. A few grassroots efforts are underway to do the job the media won't and track defensive gun uses. You can find updates on two of them here at keepandbeararms.com and claytoncramer.com.
But isn't it more likely that the bad guy's just going to take your gun away and then use it against you?
Sure, if you're attacked by Obi-Wan Kenobi and he uses some sort of Jedi mind trick to make you give up the gun, you're in trouble. But to the folks involved in the hundreds of thousands of successful defensive gun uses each year, the Jedi mind tricks proved useless. The science here is a little more realistic. The National Crime Victimization Survey data shows that Jedi weapon takeaway rates are at most 1%. And it's not like resisting a criminal attack will somehow make the aggressor more angry. One criminological survey even concluded that the use of a gun by the victim significantly reduced the chance of being injured.
But having a gun around a house is dangerous. I mean, what if there's an accident or a child finds the gun?
Yes, it's hard to have a gun accident without guns. It's also hard to have a car accident in the absence of cars, and if we banned all airplanes, they'd stop crashing too. The gun-hating media sensationalizes every gun accident, leading some to believe that such accidents are common, or maybe gun accidents are heavily covered in the press because, like plane crashes, they are so exceedingly rare. In 2005, there were 789 accidental deaths from firearms in the United States. Given our population, that means that the risk of a fatal gun accident in America was 0.3 per 100,000 people, approximately the same risk of dying in a plane crash or from bronchitis. Of course, most people don't fly or contract respiratory illnesses every day, but they do usually bathe. And that's super dangerous for children relative to having guns in the home. In 2003, children 14 and under suffered 56 fatal gun accidents. But that same year, 86 children drowned in bathtubs and 285 children drowned in pools. For kids under 10 years old, the numbers are even more dramatic. As noted by economists Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner, the likelihood of death by pool, 1 in 11,000 versus death by gun, 1 in 1 million plus, isn't even close.
Well, I might kill myself, or my kid could kill himself if he had a really bad day.
That is complete nonsense. The causes of suicide are complex, but one aspect of this tragic phenomenon is clear. People do